Hi, I'm Lawrence Diamond.
And I'm Bob Matthews.
And this is The Process of Production.
Mate, how's your week been?
It's been a hot one. You'll either be listening to this in the middle of a heat wave, or you'll be aware that we just went through a crazy heat wave.
Or you might be in some other part of the world.
But, you may be in some other part of the world. That's so true. If you're not in Britain, you're not in the grips of a heat wave. So shout out our international listeners, of which there are many. But yeah, trying to keep cool, trying to keep equipment cool, trying to survive. Maybe not thrive, but survive.
I was lucky enough to be able to do the majority of my work yesterday in Sam Klempner's room at my studio, not mine, because mine does not have any air conditioning.
Understood.
Whereas Sam's got a nice air conditioning unit and just kept it at a cool 20C and had a lovely time. And then he came in a bit later in the day and he gave me a nice little production tip, actually, that I thought I'd share. He had this kind of pop track that had this sort of groovy disco bass guitar riff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, that sounds really fat. Like, how did you get that sound, Sam? And he was like, yeah, it's just, you know, it's a bass guitar. And then underneath, he'd sort of doubled it with a sub bass. And this might sound really obvious, but for me, the way he'd done it was really simple and elegant. He'd just got the, in Logic, he'd got the EXS24, which is the sampler, but with no patch loaded. So then it just plays a sine wave. And he'd literally just use that. He'd adjusted the envelope a bit, so the attack and the release, so it doesn't have all that clicky sound when you turn it on and off. And then he'd kind of... He couldn't remember if he just played it in or pulled the MIDI from the bass guitar audio.
Mm-hmm.
And then just had that, like, doing an octave lower, like, quite subby, like, in the sort of sub-100 hertz region. And you couldn't really hear it when the bass was playing, but it was adding a real thickness and, like...
Nice bit of heft down there.
Yeah, really hefty, and, like, an extra voice below. And it was kind of like a doom, 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 kind of more staccato-y bass, disco-y thing. It was just interesting that you can have that kind of layer of sub on there. To some of our listeners, that might be a super obvious thing, but like to me, I was like, oh yeah, that's a really kind of
I also love the idea of Sam and or any producer has just gotten some like fly like session bass player to just do this like jazzy funky thing, and then just like, if they're not pulling the MIDI from the audio, they're just like rolling up their sleeves by their MIDI keyboard and they're like, stand back guys, I'm doubling it.
Yeah.
And they're just like, what key are we in?
Yeah.
F sharp minor? Stand back, here I go. Fiddle-bum, bum, bum, bum. Fiddle-bum, bum, bum, bum. And just laying it in and like tucking it in the mix. Love that.
Sam is very capable of that. And we were looking at the MIDI and it was pretty bang on the grid. So maybe the bass had been edited and stuff.
Sure.
And then you had that nice, like, tight, we're able to match it nice and tight. And yeah, track was sounding awesome.
Lovely, lovely. Yeah. Well, the interview we're doing this week, I seem to remember we recorded it during a lovely sunny day. And our guest this week is Katie Tavini. It's our mastering engineer episode.
Yes.
Which I feel always lands about now in our series.
We've got to do at least one a series going forward, I think.
It was Kelly Hibbert in our last series.
Mm.
And that was a wonderful interview. He was out in the rainforest where he's built his studio in South America, Central America.
And you can actually hear birdsong on this recording.
Yeah,
Katie's
I seem to remember
mic.
It being a really sunny, beautiful day. And Katie has a home mastering studio with this beautiful jungle wallpaper and the light was shining in. And her collective, she's begun the first mastering collective, is named after that wallpaper, Weird Jungle. So not only do we have a mastering engineer theme, we have a mastering engineer jungle adjacent.
Oh yeah.
Mastering,
okay, we're painting ourselves into a corner here with the jungle related mastering.
I hear that. We've got a year to figure this one out.
Yeah, and she's a great mastering engineer who does all sorts of genres. Has been nominated for the Music Producers Guild Mastering Engineer of the Year 3 times, which is
fantastic.
Quite some achievement. She's also one of the founding members of the 2% Rising movement, which is a group for women and gender minorities who work in music production and engineering to kind of come together as a community and hopefully encourage each other and maybe help grow that 2% figure, which, as you may know, refers to the number of female and gender minority people that there are working in our industry, which is obviously an insanely low figure.
Katie talks a lot about support and people coming together to help develop careers, which I find really interesting. And then on the total flip side, she talks a lot about labeling files correctly and delivering things in the right format, which...
Yeah, she was at pains to say how much of a big part of the job that is.
And man, I'm into that stuff. So there's a whole gamut of stuff in this interview. So thank you so much to Katie for being our guest this week. We hope you enjoy it. And should we take it away, Bob?
Yeah, see you on the other side.
Katie Tavini is a mastering engineer based in Brighton, England. Originally combining her nascent mastering career with a full-time role as an audio archivist, a nomination for the Music Producers Guild Mastering Engineer of the Year saw her, after a period of reflection that she talks about in this interview, taking on her craft full-time. Credits with Mercury-nominated Nadine Shah, Mercury winner Arlo Parks, Los Bichos and Ash followed, as well as two further nominations for MPG Mastering Engineer of the Year. She has also recently started a mastering collective, Weird Jungle, that brings together like-minded mastering engineers under one umbrella to offer the best service to the diverse range of artists Katie finds herself working with. But we start by getting the lowdown on how Katie actually came to the craft of mastering. We always say maybe you don't grow up dreaming of maybe being a mastering engineer. You may be different, but it seems like there's always a pathway into it. And it's always quite an interesting pathway for people.
Yeah, it was definitely an accident. No one dreams of doing... I don't know. Dream of doing mastering? No one... I've never spoken to anyone that mastering's been their first goal.
Sure.
Apart from students in uni sometimes... Some of them are like, oh, I really want to do mastering. But I guess if you're doing a production course, you will know what it is. Whereas I didn't do that. Yeah. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
Still don't. I'm joking. am I?
or am I?
yeah, I don't know. I started as a studio engineer and then kind of moved on to a bit of production. But I was really bad at mixing, so...
You've said that in some of your articles. I find that really interesting, and I'm sure that there's an element of modesty in there. Did you just not take to it as a craft or not enjoy it?
There's so many options, and I've got a really, really short attention span.
Mm-hmm.
And the thought of sort of working on the same thing for... I don't even know how long it takes to mix something.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe like a day or two.
Yeah.
I don't have the attention span for that. Or the patience. I used to get really hung up on the fact that I could just never get it right. Yeah, I used to put the hours in practicing and kind of got really disheartened. Just kind of fell into mastering and then realised that I don't have to mix anymore. This is really nice.
Yeah, so mastering clearly suits you for some reason, and maybe it suits your temperament a bit more or something, and you've clearly got a talent for it. And I just think that's really interesting because I've always seen it as something you kind of graduate to. You learn production, you start to learn mixing, and then you can take some of those skills you've got from mixing and kind of take them to a really refined point and finish the track in mastering. But I think it's quite refreshing to think about it as kind of quite a different discipline than mixing, and not necessarily on the same branch of the tree. How would you describe it?
Yeah, it's definitely a different headspace. I think it's dead satisfying to finish something.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that. And I think that's why mastering works for me. Because you're finishing something and you're sort of packaging it up in a little folder and going, there you go.
Yeah.
There's your baby ready to like enter the world. That's dead nice.
Yeah. Should we talk about Weird Jungle? Because you've just launched and it's described as a creative mastering collective. And a mastering collective is kind of a new concept to me. Obviously, you've got the big mastering houses, but tell us what this is.
I basically sold it to my manager as I want to make a virtual mastering house.
Uh-huh.
Because when you're a freelancer and you've got your own little studio and you just do you, you've got no one to learn from. You've got no colleagues, but also there's no... there's no regulations in mastering or in audio in general. It's creative. I got like dead busy last summer-ish. So I started kind of recommending this guy just for stuff that I couldn't take on. And he did an amazing job, but I recommended him because his mastering sounds really, really similar to mine. He works in a similar way to me. He's dead nice, dead friendly, but also the way he sends masters and packages everything up, it's in a really sort of logical order and easy to find, which I think is a really sort of big part of mastering as well. Mm-hmm. And every person who I recommended him to came back and said, oh, thanks for the recommendation. Oh, he's called Stephen Kerrison, by the way.
Give him his props, yeah.
yeah. Wonderful mastering engineer. But everyone said, oh, thanks for recommending Stee. Had a great time. And I just kind of thought, oh, I wanna work with Stee and have him as a colleague, like an actual, like, proper. And then, so yeah, we've been working together since, I think, last August. Then last year I did some mentoring as well for Saffron Records, who are for, it's kind of a label and education program for gender minorities in music. And so they paired me up with Izzy McPhee, who wanted to be a mix engineer.
Okay.
But she's not anymore. No, she is. She does mix. She's amazing at mixing, but...
But you're like, let me bring you into the dark world of mastering.
Well, you know, she, in one of our mentoring sessions, she said to me, Katie, I've been asked to master something, but I don't really know what I'm doing. Can you check it? So I said, yeah, just send me the, you know, the mastered file and the original file as well, and I'll have a listen and feedback. And then I emailed her. I was like, are you sure you've never mastered anything before? Because this is great. So we've been working together probably since last June, just on a sort of mentor basis. And she really got into mastering quite heavily through our time on the mentoring program. And then, you know, a lot of people want to work with me because I'm female, and I get that, but I can't do it all because it's too much. So, you know, we kind of had this idea of a virtual mastering house in my head, really wanted some colleagues, really wanted to have, you know, people to learn from, and also a bit of a safety net, because what if you're ill?
Yeah.
And you're freelance, like, you know, if people are booking 6 weeks in advance for you and then you're ill and their deadline kind of is relying on you being able to do this, then that's a bit of a tricky situation. Yeah, kind of brought Izzy in. I'm QCing everything that she does at the moment, but she's absolutely smashing it. Yeah, it's just a really nice team. It's really fun as well because you get to learn from other people.
It can be such a lonely experience, production, mixing, mastering, all of them. Like, I've always said, like, Bob, the reason me and Bob do this, Bob's sort of been my mentor in production, and I get to talk to him and learn, and we work together, and there's a couple of other people we work with. And it's so important because you are often in a bedroom or a mix studio or a little room on your own, and it's unusual. It's a strange existence.
Yeah.
It is. I think it's really important as well because I don't do attendance sessions. Like, you know, just having people that I can phone up and go, what are you doing?
Yeah.
How would you approach this track? You know, just someone to bounce ideas off, because, yeah, I miss that. I do. It's weird. I'm a sociable person doing a really isolating job, which I love, my job. But yeah, so we made Weird Jungle, and it's been great. It's been great seeing how Izzy and Stee both work. And I've learned loads from both of them.
And you're sort of bringing collectives have been a musical thing, and there's production collectives, and you're like bringing the collective idea to the mastering world. It's sort of like a pioneering move.
It's really important to me that any other engineers that I work with have to be really like the right people. Like, dead open-minded and also creative. Like, mastering can be seen as quite stuffy. And I really just want to give artists the best experience of, you know, getting their music mastered and basically making it as easy as possible for them to release their music, because releasing music's dead stressful. Like, dead stressful. And if we can all work together to sort of give artists a bit of a better time.
And that's quite, that sort of leads into a question that I think is quite interesting. Like, what do you see as your role as the mastering engineer with the artist? Like, what are you bringing both to their music, and as you've sort of alluded to, like that process of getting that music out there for them?
It definitely differs from job to job, but basically being whatever the artist needs us to be and being open-minded about that and not being set in a specific way and sort of looking at projects and thinking, right, what does this person need? How can I best help them? You know, I always think mastering's like a combination of three things. It's a quality check and making sure that, you know, the files are functioning and it happens where, you know, the end of a mix is cut off by a couple of seconds and you don't get that complete fade out or whatever.
Yeah.
Or there's a bit of talking left in a vocal mic, or there's a few like clicks and pops and stuff which you can just remove. And just making sure that the mixes really are functioning the best they can, and, you know, perhaps offering a little bit of feedback if someone says, oh, I'm really struggling to get this bit of my mix sitting right.
And do you find with where things are, maybe there is more bedroom production coming in or producer artists coming in who are releasing at a high level now because of the way the industry is, do you find that there is a bit more back and forth now where you're sort of getting in touch and going like, I could do a bit of this in mastering, but maybe just look at this stem again or your low end just a little bit. Do you try and have those dialogues with your artists?
Yeah, totally. I think it's really important. Everyone's got that same end goal, and that is to, you know, make this project the best it can sound.
Mm.
I'm on the same page as you. Let's get this sounding amazing. So
yeah, you were talking about the three that you see mastering as a combination of three things. You said the quality control and what was the rest?
So quality check and then the audio processing bit, which everyone knows about because it's that's all people talk about on the internet. Right. Just making it louder. No, I'm joking.
Yeah.
There's more to it than that, but you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the third one is kind of creating all of the formats and organizing them in a way that when the artist or, you know, the label or the manager or whoever comes to send those formats off for distribution or, you know, getting the vinyl cut or whatever, they have everything and they know what everything is and they can just find it dead easily so that they're not having to send me an email saying, oh, can we have this format? Because it's already there. Just trying to
delivery basically yeah
which is a massive part of it.
Can we get a bit deeper into your actual workflow then, like where do you start kind of, how do you approach a master, you know, like just talk us through kind of your mindset when you start work.
I just listen to the music. I always start everything as if I've never works on anything before, which is probably a really, I don't know, it's how I like to work and it's probably slows me down quite a lot, but I really like to sort of feel the music and kind of, I don't know,
build a connection with it.
Yeah.
How many times do you think you listen to something before you start making any moves?
You know what, it really depends. Sometimes I get into the first chorus or whatever and I know exactly what needs to happen.
Right.
And sometimes it really depends on how I'm feeling that day and what the music is. You know, sometimes if you're having you're in quite a low mood and you put on like a really upbeat track, it just changes your mood completely and you're like, yeah, this is amazing. I'm so happy now. But you know, other times working on music that's a little bit darker, that can take me a while to get into.
So even though you're sort of alluding to that technical aspect of delivering things right, there's still just a very emotional connection with the music when it comes to making those moves.
Yeah, because music's such a like a physical experience. It needs to be able to make you to like feel something. I can't do my job unless I'm feeling the thing that the artist wants me to feel, and I understand that and I'm able to kind of enhance that feeling for the listener. The first thing I do kind of process-wise is get a limiter and get that limiter sounding good. It'll always change kind of towards the end, but if I can just put a limiter on the track and see how it feels when it's a lot louder, because when you put a limiter on something, it does change the sound. And then I can say, you know, how loud does this track need to be? And if it's in a context of an album, I'll kind of, you know, have to go through and sort of listen to the flow of the album.
Yeah.
So within the structure of a song, you might have like verses and choruses. And then within the structure of an album, that'll have its own dynamics, and just sort of see how everything feels. And so I'll make limiter settings for all of the different songs on an album. And yeah, sometimes I'll use a different limiter for each song, and sometimes I use the same limiter for each song.
Really? Even on the same project? Yeah. I was going to ask later on, when you're mastering a whole EP or LP, how challenging is it to make sure the masters work together? So it sounds like you can't just slap the whole same settings on every single track. There's going to be lots of differences each time.
Yeah, it really depends. I think recently, since just before the pandemic, there seems to be a bit more of a trend of making an album that sounds more like a playlist.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, perhaps not exactly the same instrumentation all the way through. It's perhaps, you know, a few different styles of music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Across the album. And yeah, that's kind of just happened over the past like 2.5 years or so. And I really love working on those projects because everything's different and it kind of keeps you on your toes. And it's really interesting just putting a limiter on something and hearing the change, and then putting a different limiter on and hearing, wow, that has a completely different sound, and sort of trying to match the sound of the limiter to the song. I don't know if people care. I don't know if people can hear it, but it feels right to me. So obviously I know what the limiters I have sound like, and what they or what.
And are you mainly working on with soft limiters, or do you have some hardware that you might run it out to and be like, oh, I want to?
I always use software limiters. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I feel like it'd be too expensive to have I don't have the room. Yeah. I don't have the money.
If you're comparing all these different flavors, it's going to be quite tricky to do that effectively and quickly if you have like a bank of 4 hardware ones.
Yeah.
I guess it's.
And your electricity bill is just going to go through the roof. I know, at this point, right?
Yeah. So for my outboard, I have, it's mainly EQ. I really love EQ. That's my, it's not my favourite bit, but it kind of is.
Yeah.
I really like it.
Is that what you'd reach for after you got the limited, like, in the ballpark?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Changes on an EQ and mastering are really not that exciting. You know, compared to, like, the production process or mixing, where you're kind of doing big cuts and really shaping the tone. In mastering, it can be, like, a 1 dB cut. Yeah. That just makes the vocals sit a tiny bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes a huge difference. And when you're... Like, I always think of putting a track into a limiter as, like... Have you ever seen on, like, a train station or something, someone carrying a pet in a carrier?
Yeah.
And, like, it can be quite a fat cat and the fur's poking outside.
Yeah.
Like, I always think of limiting like that. Like, you're trying to squash the track into a box that's, like, a little bit small for it. So, like, everything becomes exaggerated at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And you can see where the hair sticks out and know exactly what you have to do about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yep.
I get it, yes.
Yes.
I like that. That's the kind of takeaway I can use in my day to day. Like,
yes.
So just spell it out. So then you can get the EQ and you can start sculpting the sound a bit more easily at that stage.
Yeah. So
your clippers and shave that little bit of hair. And you're not shaving the whole cat. That's all been done by the producer and the mixer, but you're just like, there's still a bit too much hair here, and you can
feel like this analogy is going to fall down at some point.
Well, yeah. The RSPCA is getting involved at some point, but yeah. And if you let the cat out the box, it would look the same, but it would be subtly more beautiful.
It would be.
Yes.
There we go.
And just while we're in this world, because we never know, like, where our listenership sits between sort of people that just want to hear about like someone smoking a massive reefer when they recorded a lead vocal, and people who want to know about like the 17 rack EQs that you have. But speakers are such a huge part of what you do as a mastering engineer. They're sort of,
yeah.
And how do you find that? And do you A/B? Do you have like a crap speaker so you can check it on a radio thing? Or like, how do you approach that listening experience and sort of finalizing it across those mediums?
Well, I'm going to tell you about my speakers because I really like them.
Yes, do it.
So I have some speakers which took me 4 years to save up for.
Wow.
But the first time I heard them, I was like, oh, I need them. Like, they're dead good. I don't know what it is about them. I just really like them. So, yeah, I saved up for them. And
you have to tell us them. Don't be like you were with your mastering engineer friend. Like, give them the credit they deserve.
Name, oh, yeah, yeah. The PMC226s.
Cool.
Anyway, I heard them and compared them to some other speakers at the time. It was like you know, those trade show type things.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, I yeah. was like, oh, no, not into the other ones, but those are like, they're good. Want them.
Sweet.
But everything to do with music costs a lot of money, so
sure.
It was a lot of saving up. And when I got them, I had been mastering projects before I got them, but I noticed just a difference in how I was listening
mm-hmm.
when I got these speakers. I've now had them for 4 years, four and a bit years, so I know them really well. And I've been working in this room for 2.5 years. So again, I know this room really, really well. And I think a really big part of making sure stuff translates is knowing your room and your speakers. So what I do is listen to loads of music in here. Especially nice. When I first put my studio in here, pretty much every day I'd be in here listening to just anything. So both stuff I know really, really well and also stuff that I don't, and it's totally new to me, just to kind of get cool. used to everything.
So you think knowing the setup and just being used to it is way more important than having loads of different references and listening on a crap speaker, or do you do that stuff as well?
I do have headphones, check. I don't listen on crap speakers because, and you know what, this is a bit like the whole, oh, do you make masters different for iTunes and then for Spotify and then for Tidal and stuff? Like, I feel like if you can get a piece of music sounding the best it can, it will translate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, crap speakers, they're always evolving. They're always getting better.
Sure. Yeah,
but whereas
yeah, yeah.
if you tailor something to a crap speaker now, it's going to be a different crap speaker in 10 years' time. It's not necessarily going to sound the same. And then in 10 years' time, when crap speakers sound different, you can't exactly go back and be like, oh, let's get everything remastered for these new crap speakers. So I just think as long as you make everything sound as best as it can at the moment on, you know, whatever gear you have, then you're sort of onto a winner.
Right.
That's a really interesting answer, and it sort of makes a lot of, yeah. Suddenly you've got a really good crap speaker and they're like, why didn't they put something around here in the mastering? And they're like, oh, because 10 years ago that wouldn't have been there. And it's like, well, now it's here. Could I have it back, please? Yeah.
That your comment about kind of mastering for Spotify, Tidal and so on is kind of, it leads me on to another question. So in terms of how you think about loudness when you work, because I guess one thing that we spoke to one other mastering engineer last year and he said, it's kind of changed the loudness wars in that because there's no longer like people aren't racing to the top. There is a bit less of a kind of raging demand for like relentless loudness because of the kind of whatever it is that the DSPs do to kind of even things out. Have you noticed like clients asking for stuff to be smashed less, or is that still just absolutely rife?
I feel like there's a sweet spot for everything. You don't want to listen to a really dynamic punk track.
It's just, yes.
It's not going to be fun.
Yeah.
But again, you don't want to listen to like a string quartet that's been smashed. Again, it's really not going to be fun. So I feel like you know, the style has a lot to, that really is what dictates, you know, how something should feel, because, you know, you don't want a dance track to feel really empty. You want it to hit hard. You want it to, you want to be able to feel it.
Do you worry about like kind of loudness targets and like look at, constantly looking at luffs meters and all that kind of stuff?
No, I'm not very technical. No, I mean, they are useful if you're new to mastering. Like, it's a really good idea to know how those work and why they're a thing. It's really weird because my kind of approach to this has really changed the more I do. I would have probably taken that like really seriously a few years ago, whereas now I think it's a combination of people aren't asking for stuff to be super super loud all the time. Occasionally people will want stuff louder, but also knowing the style of music that you're working on and like doing your research and kind of listening to other stuff and knowing how something should feel. I feel like you can feel it.
So you don't spend your whole time looking at meters now. You use your ears, I guess.
Yeah, like you can hear if something's overcompressed, or you can hear if a limit is killing the life out of a track.
Cool. No, that's good. That's
it. I think I'd just rather something be musical than loud for the sake of loud. You know, sometimes I have had to explain to people, like, you know, if they've gone, oh, can we have it louder? Then just say, it's not necessarily going to sound as good. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can compromise.
The first time you were nominated for MPG Master of the Year, which kind of sort of should have been like, you know, that's sort of a pinnacle in many ways, and nice to have that acknowledgement. And you said it sort of actually triggered a period of anxiety, and it's I've had my own troubles with that in my music career as well, and I've had a lot of truth in what you were writing about. But also, I'd like to hear the story of that, and also how mastering that Nadine Shah album, which is a great album, sort of brought you out of that and got you excited about it again. And just as you're comfortable, just sort of talk about that experience that you wrote about, and how that album sort of brought you back to music. I think it'd be really interesting to hear if you're happy to talk about that.
Yeah, so the first time I got nominated for that award.
Yeah, three-time nominated, by the way, listeners. Three-time nominated. Let's put that on record.
It's very strange. But so the first time I got nominated, I had a full-time job. Wow. So, you know, I think it's that feeling of going to work every day doing something that's not mastering, but then also being on this list next to, you know, I know Matt Colton was on that list because he won that year and he is phenomenal. You know, Matt's first credit on Discogs was from when I was 10 years old.
Amazing.
And he's mastered so many of my favourite albums. So to be next to him on a list when mastering is not my, or was not at the time, my full-time job. I had maybe 50 releases. And I was going to work every day just feeling like a fraud, because my life at the time was archiving and then sort of, you know, learning about mastering outside of that and working a little bit as a mastering engineer of that. But it was not, it wasn't something that at the time I thought could be a full-time job. My kind of goal was, well, if I can do mastering part-time and then do something else the rest of the time, fine. Being nominated for something of that scale, it just made me feel like the biggest fraud. Like, I did not belong in that list. I just didn't feel, you know, it was, yeah, it was terrifying. When you're shortlisted, you have to submit tracks for a judging day where people get together and listen to your work and talk about it and then vote. And
sure.
So, you know, just the thought of that made me feel physically sick.
Sure.
Because, you know, how can I compare to people who've been mastering since I was in primary school, and also they're working in incredible studios with other engineers, and I'm just me, like, learning how to use an EQ. I don't know. I didn't work for, like, oh, I didn't do any mastering work for about 2 months after that, just because every time someone asked me, you know, when a booking came in through my website, I just had to say, sorry, I'm not taking on work at the moment because I felt physically ill. Which is, it's so hard as well when people congratulate you. So many people congratulated me and you have to thank them because it's really nice that they're congratulating you. But when you don't feel deserving of that congratulations, it's really hard.
And then this Nadine Shah album, which is a great album, that sort of was your tonic, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been a fan of Nadine's for a long time. I think she's amazing. Holiday Destination's probably one of my favourite albums. So to then get an email in my inbox asking to do a test master was pretty nuts. All my other jobs had sort of been my friends' bands. And sort of smaller indie type gigs and, you know, amazing music. But sort of, yeah, maybe not on the scale, but also because I sort of a big Nadine fangirl.
Yeah. It's like, oh my God. A different feeling, pressure kind of coming into that. Yeah.
Like pressure, but also like, holy shit, if I don't do this, I'm really going to kick myself. So yeah, just. And you know what? Working on the album was so amazing because, you know, like I said, I've never had any kind of mentoring and I'm completely self-taught. But Ben Hillier, who produced the album, sort of, he really guided me through the process and really sort of helped me listen for things that I'd not really been listening for before. And that really, really changed how I work. It kind of started a bit of a snowball effect. So once I'd done that album, I guess I worked with people maybe every 2 months who then again sort of added to my knowledge, I'm really grateful for.
It was sort of a gateway into that kind of leveling up of with it. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And then, yeah, that was really my first experience of working with people who didn't already know. Being nominated is still weird. Like, every single time I've been nominated now, I have had a massive wobbler.
Wait till you win it.
No. I think it's the feeling of being compared to other people because music's such an individual thing and all engineers are different. And, yeah, how can you compare? Yeah, I'm grateful. I am really grateful and I can see that now, but at the time, I was really strange. Like, knowing that you should be grateful for something and having people say, oh, congratulations, well done. And you thinking, I should not be on that list. It's really weird.
Shakespeare once said that music is the food of love. But what is the food of music? As much as the right microphone or guitar amp, what we eat or drink can be such a crucial part of a recording session. So each week we like to ask our guests, what do they cook or order to get the mood right in the studio?
Well, you know what? When I'm working, like, food is very functional. So, like, protein shakes are quite a big thing.
Yeah.
So this is really boring.
No, it's good to know what we go to.
Cups of tea, matcha. I don't drink coffee.
Oh, okay.
But, like, you know, sometimes in the afternoon I do make a fancy cup of tea, you know, like the loose leaf stuff. And, like, I've got, like, a fancy Earl Grey and a chai tea. Yeah, so I quite like a fancy cup of tea in the afternoon.
What's your favourite studio you've ever worked in?
Well, mine.
It's got to be yours, right?
It has to be.
Look at it. I mean, our listeners can't see the amazing sort of jungle leaf wallpaper, is it?
Or
is
it a weird jungle wallpaper, I'm guessing, right?
Well, you know what? So sometimes when you work for a label, your name isn't enough for the credit. They need to name the actual location as well. And I used to just tell people, just make up a studio name for me.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, there are some bizarre credits out there, which I think is really fun. But it got to the point where people were asking too often and, you know, repeat people were getting bored of making up a new location. So I said to my Instagram followers, what should I name my studio? And Weird Jungle was the strongest.
Makes sense now.
Nice, simple one. What's your favourite plugin?
So it's this McDSP one.
Oh, yeah.
It's a dynamics processor. That's all I can describe it of. But it's like a limiter, a multiband compressor thing. And it does other things too. But I really like that. Not necessarily as a limiter, but as the multiband compressor, because it sounds really good.
Is it the ML4000?
It is.
All right, let's bring it back to the real world. What's your favourite piece of hardware?
So I have this EQ, which is called an IGS Tilt and Bands.
And Tilt EQ.
Again, it's really fun. It's like a broad strokes EQ. Yeah. And it's really fun. Hold on. Let me just turn it on for you and then you can see. I know no one's going to
beautiful.
See this, but...
Yes.
Oh, wow.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah, that's sick. Are there some valves in there or something? Oh, look at them light up.
Can you see
wow.
That?
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
That's the monitoring-y bit.
It's going like cyan-coloured now. What the hell?
Yes. It looks like something you'd have in a spaceship.
It does. And I like how big the dials are.
That sounds like satisfying.
Submarine or something. Anyway, that is...
That's wicked.
You know what? I don't use it very often, but when I do, it's really exciting.
We've talked about this earlier, but now we're going to ask you to put a name on it too. Do you have a favourite limiter?
Oh, it changes every day. It changes every day. At the moment, I like the Limitless one. Limitless.
Oh, yeah. Talk us through a couple of your favourites and kind of just briefly what flavour, if you can describe it, if it's... You can put it into words, because I know we're talking about very subtle differences here between the limiters.
Yeah, so Limitless Limiter, it's dead easy to make stuff like loud, but it's really transparent.
Nice.
So think of that as your like no makeup.
Okay.
And then I like the Sonox Limiter. I think that sounds, that's quite a warm sounding limiter. I use that quite a bit on acoustic music or...
Is that the Oxford limiter?
Yeah. Yes. Sometimes I use the two. So I use the Oxford limiter first and then Limitless.
Ooh, yeah.
And then I think the Fab Filter limiter's got to have a mention as well because...
Is that the Pro-L, I think that's called, or something like that?
I don't know. Just
it doesn't
red
matter. Yeah,
one.
The Fab Filter. Yeah, I think, yeah.
I like this. What's the work you're most proud of? Like, if there was one mastering project that you were like, at the moment, that's the definitive piece of my work that I love. Is there one you'd point to?
Oh, I love them all. I don't know. I feel like Nadine's album, Kitchen Sink, is, you know, that was a really big, a big milestone for me. Also, Sega Bodega's last album, Romeo.
Oh, like. Nice.
I love him. I think he's an incredible producer.
The final question that we always ask everyone is, what's the most important tool at your disposal as a producer, but for you, for what you do as a mastering engineer?
Like ears and hearing. Look after your hearing.
Yeah.
Like get your earplugs made up and
yeah.
Yeah, do that whole thing, look after hearing. And then, yeah, speakers that you trust. I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
Lovely.
Katie, thank you so much.
Ooh, yeah. High five.
Fantastic interview with Katie. I always when you were like, I think we should do some mastering engineers, I was like, that is a deep dive, mate. But both of our mastering engineer interviews have been really interesting. They're always really popular as well. So you guys obviously want to know a little bit about that dark art of mastering your music.
Still a massive part of the process of what we do. Mm. Like every song goes through it in some respect, even if you're self-mastering your own demos. And it seems like such a small percentage of the whole process when you look at it from the artist's point of view, because it's just this tiny bit at the end of a potentially years-long road to getting a track done. But it's hugely important, and it's the finishing step, it's the final furlong. So I think it is really interesting, and because it is shrouded in some mystery, hopefully it's interesting for everyone, whether you're doing your own mastering or not.
Yeah, definitely. I think Katie's a really good voice to sort of demystify it in a way. And you pointed out in the interview, it's interesting that she didn't really come at it from a mixing angle. She realized that her skill set and her love of music and how she engaged with music, that actually mastering was going to be the path for her. And I think that's an interesting thing to hear from her, and also a great lesson for anyone coming through, like gravitate to what satisfies you and what you feel you're cut out to do.
Yeah, it's really cool. I've always seen mastering as kind of a rarefied mixing that's kind of like distilling those mixing skills down to the finest point to finish a whole track. But she's kind of made me realize that it's a very different discipline, and it requires different skills, and most importantly, a different mindset. Which she clearly, her mindset wasn't right for mixing for whatever reason, but it suits mastering really, really well. And it's so cool that she really connects with the music as part of her process. And it's not like a scientific thing where she's just listening for frequencies. She talks about the mood of the music, the genre of the music, and how important that is to the decisions she makes. So
sometimes listening to the songs in isolation, sometimes seeing them as part of the whole, and even deciding when that's necessary as well, and things and the choices that leads you to make.
Yeah, really cool. It's good to hear, because sometimes, I don't know, especially if you use like an online mastering service and you don't have that much dialogue with the mastering engineer, maybe it's you fear that they just run it through some standard settings and it's just like a cookie cutter and it's on to the next one. But hopefully there aren't mastering engineers out there like that. And Katie's clearly the opposite and takes a careful and bespoke view on each project.
And that sort of leads into what she's also building with Weird Jungle, which is building a collective of people who, when you come to them, you know you're going to get that care about their mastering. And it's sort of, it feels like a decision that's really sympathetic to one's workflow as a music professional, in terms of, as she talks about, you know, if you're self-employed, you're booking 6 weeks in advance and you get COVID, you can't master that record at that point.
Yeah.
But then you are able to serve yourself and your customer by going, this guy masters like me. This woman masters like me. We have this feel. We understand the music. We get where you're coming from.
Yeah.
And I can plug you into that, and that doesn't slow down your project. And it also just alleviates something from me.
Completely.
Really cool, really simple, really obvious. Not really heard of it before.
No, unless you're thinking about the big mastering houses, like outside of that world, I can't imagine it's a popular thing. And in our business, it's so common to sort of feel like your contemporaries are your competitors. Mm. Whereas really, more often than not, if you club together with others, you're going to be more than the sum of your parts.
And you make a good point there, Bob, because maybe 15 years ago, we weren't all so atomized. We weren't all sat in our bedrooms, just like we are now tracking a podcast. We were in studios, or we were in mastering houses, or we certainly knew like two or three other mastering houses that we maybe all worked at. I mean, not we, one had all worked at.
Yeah.
But now you can, as she alluded to, she had never gone through that. She was archiving audio as she built her mastering career, so she didn't have that network of contacts. And yeah, really cool. And it's a really interesting part of this podcast. As we go, as we interview people, we see the industry evolving in real time. Yeah. We see the craft evolving in real time, away from the basics of song creation, which evolves at a rapid pace, but also about how you have to do things and how you can work.
Yeah, it's a very different world than it was when, you know, maybe me and you first picked up a bass guitar or whatever.
And you booked a rehearsal room and off you went. Yes, it's so true.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see that happen in real time. You're right, because it is always evolving.
Did you get some nice limiter love going on?
I was just going to say it was lovely hearing like her takes on like how the individual limiters, you know, color the sound. That was super cool. And I hope
great analogy. I thought that cat analogy stood strong through the whole unpacking, and it did help me think about it. Like, get that limiter on early, hear what it's doing, make it transparent, so you can just go like, "Whoa, that I didn't see that was a bit funny then, but now I see it." Yes,
it is cool, and I guess that's why some people use a limiter. A lot of people use a limiter during the mix process as well, because it's always going to completely change the track. My only issue with the analogy was like that you don't usually shave cats.
Well, that's maybe your problem, mate. That's where your cats are going wrong and your mastering. I suppose only if they're having an operation.
Only when they need stitches, I guess, then you get the funny little shaved belly.
Fair point. Yeah. This has taken a turn.
Yeah.
It's a massive thank you to Katie. We got some limiter love. We got some self-employed insights. And most importantly, we maintained our mastering jungle theme. All I can think is we should maybe investigate who masters jungle's records.
That's a good idea. I reckon we can get to three on this at least.
Book them in for an episode next year.
Yeah.
Or maybe find who mastered Welcome to the Jungle by Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, or who was the definitive master of the jungle music scene?
Funny you should talk about mastering and jungle and all that kind of genres. I read an amazing book, Sounds Like London, which is the history of kind of Black Caribbean immigrant music in London. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole thing about how individuals from the community set up their own mastering lathes because the traditional mastering houses couldn't keep the needles on for like the incredible bass that these producers were bringing in the early reggae, dancehall, and eventually the kind of drum and bass and jungle movement. They just didn't, you know, they were used to mastering Fleetwood Mac albums for like that's their 10th repress.
Yeah, are we talking like 70s here? Or
I think it's early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. I haven't read the book for a while, so I don't want to say something wrong. But yeah, these guys would set up in industrial units, they'd get the mastering lathe, and everyone knew if you wanted your track to kind of hit right, you couldn't be going to the normal places. You had to know these guys in Camden and in Hackney, maybe South London, and get that's your lathe cool. cut. I'll dig that out and have a read, and then maybe we can circle back to it. It's a fascinating, fascinating story. The whole
good
book,
pick.
Sounds Like London, is Sounds an incredible like book. So.
Okay, cool. Nice one, mate. Well, that's a nice one place to leave it for this week. See you guys next time.
We'll see you next time. Have a great one.
Bye. Thank you for listening to The Process of Production this week. If you enjoyed it, please give us a follow and maybe even a 5-star review on whatever platform you listen to your podcasts on. It really helps. And please get in touch if you have any thoughts on the show, questions you'd like answered, or producers you'd like to see interviewed. We'd love to hear from you. Our Instagram is @processofproduction and our email is processofproductionpodcast@gmail.com.